Well, good morning, everyone. We've already got a technical difficulty, so we'll get it up here in a second. There are lots of seats up front and over. This is a great big room, but there's lots of places up front for you folks in the back. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Bob and the committee for inviting me to be the speaker this morning. It's with an incredible humility that I stand up here. For all these many years that I've been in the beef cattle industry, I'm going to put this up here. The Dick Quazes and the John Pollocks and Larry Cundiffs and these great men have been, to me, giants. And it's just humbling to be in their presence and to talk about their Dr. Quaz's great work. I'm not the scientist that those men are, and I know that. I wasn't as good a rancher as many of you are, and I know that. But I seem to have a curiosity or a something about me, a restlessness that has led me down a path to ask some pretty good questions, and here I am today, standing in the shadow of the giants of this industry. In the last 6.5 years, I had the privilege to work in Kingsville, Texas, with some of the greatest young people that you can imagine. And one of them was Dr. Craig Payne, who's now on the faculty of this great university. Craig was in the second class of the institute, and it was a real joy to know and work with Craig, and it's great to see him again. And also here with us today, we have another one of our students, J.D. Radakovich, and J.D. was a real treat. He's just as witty and bigger than his dad, so it was a challenge, I'll tell you. But for this program, I asked one of my students for some help because this was a big challenge for me. I asked Jen Johnson to help me, and I put her, you know, Jen and I wrote the paper together and developed these slides. So I owe a lot of gratitude to Jen for over the last couple of months doing it all on emails and phone calls. Well, I'm going to talk to you today about looking at the world a little bit differently. And these are the outline of what we're going to do. I'm going to introduce you to kind of a novel way of looking at the world. I'm going to review with you the principles of complex systems. I'm going to look at beef improvement through some different lenses than I think you're used to looking through. And I'm going to offer examples of systems thinking and beef improvement. So that's what we're going to do over the next few minutes. But in particular, I'm going to challenge you to think about beef improvement not as a puzzle to be solved, but as a mystery to be unraveled. And I'll explain that in a minute. Well, why would I suggest that we take a different approach to beef improvement than I think we've taken in the past? And why would I call it a systems approach? And I'm going to offer up a few reasons. Well, first, because in spite of growing worldwide populations and demand for animal protein, in particular beef, the U.S. beef industry is contracting. And for the first time in my adult life, so 40 years, the debate about whether or not the beef industry is on a sustainable path is out in front of us. And we're no longer just talking about, is the dairy, modern American dairy industry sustainable? We're talking about, and we're making analogies to the sheep industry of the 1940s. Will we ship food production across the oceans or south across our borders? And will we have a viable cattle and food animal production in the United States? I'm talking to you today about this topic and this way of looking at things because I think some of the basic assumptions that we've had about beef are just very naive. It's amazing to look back and to think that Dr. Wayne Purcell at Virginia Tech shook us all up in the 1990s about beef demand. We've been in the business for 100 years, and it was Wayne's great work that really shook us to our core as we watched our industry erode away and beef demand collapse through the 80s and the 90s. But it's not until the Great Recession of 2007, 2008 did we figure out that the elasticity for demand for beef wasn't the same across, let alone all products being offered, all carcasses, all populations. We have been very, very naive about the complexity of the economy that we play in our industry. The elasticity for beef is very, very different for choice than it is for hamburger. And we found that out. And so as we build complex models and complex tools and we lock in fixed economic relationships, I think it's just, it behooves us to re-examine that with fresh eyes. I'm here to tell you today that we can't just invest our way to profitability. And I worry that many of the discussions about beef improvement have taken us down that path. And I have sat at the kitchen tables of literally hundreds of ranchers, and I've worked with feed yards, and I'm here to tell you that there's a very limited number of people in this industry that understand the profit drivers of their business and their cost structure. So I'm going to tell you a kind of a brief synopsis of beef improvement from my perspective. So I ranched for 20 years. I've been an academia som. I was trained as a nutritionist. I'm not a geneticist. I was at South Dakota State when Chris Dinkle was there, and Dr. Dinkle was a brilliant man, didn't like nutritionists, and for those of you who remember him, would wait till we got to seminar, because we were all afraid to take his classes, and then he'd just do what Dr. Quaz was said to do. He would just nail us with tough questions. So I'm not a geneticist and an animal breeder, but this is my kind of simplistic view of beef improvement over the last 40, 50 years. The most popular strategies have focused on ways to increase gene frequency of economically relevant traits. Pretty simple. And then, once identified, to speed their diffusion through our industry with multiple approaches, or through cattle populations and change our industry. And so the tools are pretty simple, aren't they? For many years in my life, it was quantitative genetics. Now it's molecular genetics. But really, both of those tools just identify the outliers that allow us to create the change that we want. And then we take a series of, take a series of techniques and other tools to diffuse those genes as fast as we can with breeding systems and rapid genetic turnover or generational turnover, with artificial insemination, with ester synchronization, sex semen. And those are just tools for the diffusion of genes. So how's that going for us? Well, we certainly have created change. And Dave Nichols highlighted that change for us last night. It's very, very dramatic. We've got, we are producing, with the same number of cattle as Dave said last night, as 1958, we're producing probably 1.5 times as much beef, maybe even greater than that. We're going to produce 26, 27 billion pounds of beef with the smallest number of cattle that this industry has had in 40 years, 50 years. But my concern, and the concern about are we going the way of the American dairy industry or the sheep industry, is has the beef industry itself become the ultimate game of survival? And if you remember, if you look on that logo, it says outwit, outplay, outlast. We've lost well over a third of our cattle producers since 1980. We're down to a fraction, a small number of packing plants. And feed yards are under contraction. And I don't mean to be so negative, but there are areas in the United States where you can't get a semi to haul cattle out, or if you can, you can't afford to. So what if we changed our views about the world around us and specifically about beef improvement? And I'm going to use a kaleidoscope analogy. I have a kaleidoscope collection and that I enjoy with, especially with kids. And so that's my kind of metaphor that I'm going to use today. So I'm going to change for a few minutes. I'm going to try to change the way we look at beef improvement. So I just changed that slide and changed the, twisted the kaleidoscope for us. I'm going to talk about some different things. If you haven't read one of those four books or all of those four books, please read all four of those books. Malcolm Gladwell is one of the geniuses of modern America. He's a brilliant young man. He's written four of the most provocative books I've ever read. And it's come to the point where it's considered Gladwellian philosophy. They're simple to read, and maybe that's his greatest gift. So The Tipping Point, Outliers, Blink, and What the Dog Saw. Unusual books, names, it's just as unusual a character as he is. But you can pick them up at Barnes & Noble, you can get them off Amazon, you can get them at any airport bookstore. And they read fast and they're fun. Well, I'm just going to pull out a highlight for you today about just one small bit of his philosophy. In What the Dog Saw, Gladwell, which is a collection of his essays, Gladwell, one of those is called Open Secrets. And in that small essay, he talks eloquently about two ways of looking at the world. The first one is to look look at problems in particular. The first one is to look at it as a puzzle, which he says, and this is a quote, is transmitter dependent. Puzzles turn on what we are told. So his example was Enron and the 9/11 Commission, where two examples. But Enron was convicted, and the leaders of Enron were convicted on evidence that they themselves had submitted in their tax returns into the SEC. There wasn't any secrets of what Enron had done. And in looking back, it was absolutely 100% predictable that that company would fail because of their business, the fraudulent business techniques that they were reporting themselves. They had self-reported it all, and we couldn't see it. No one could see that that company was going to fail until it did. And much like that in the 9/11 Commission, you know, there's their kind of scathing report about our intelligence community was that every bit of the information we needed to stop that terrible attack we had in one or another place within that intelligence community. And what we didn't do was put it all together. We didn't synthesize it. And Gladwell says, because we have become puzzle people who wait to have things handed to us rather than solve them ourselves or synthesize them ourselves. So his challenge is not to look at the world as a puzzle, but as a mystery to be solved. And he says that mysteries are receiver dependent. They turn on the skills of the listener. It's about our ability to synthesize information that allows us, those people who can do it that way, to be so successful. And he offers up many, many examples. But I'm not going to go through today. I'm going to switch quickly to beef improvement. So, if beef improvement is a puzzle, how would that look? Well, this is how I think it looks. And if you disagree with me, that's great. And I'd love to debate this over the next. I'll be here till Thursday afternoon, and love to debate this. And I wonder what that is. So, beef improvement is a puzzle. I think we've approached beef improvement as a puzzle to be solved, and we've waited for a constant flow of techniques and technologies, and then we've adopted them. And here's my list. So we started out with ratios and breeding values and EPDs, and then we switched to markers and SNPs and whole gene, genomically enhanced EPDs and whole animal panels. A series of technologies and techniques to move beef improvement forward. And we used breeding systems and crossbreeding and then composites, and we diffused that with AI, and we used ester synchronization, and now we have sex semen, and we can move those technologies quickly through our system. And we've changed cattle. I'm not arguing that at all. What I'm arguing is what has been the impact of that change. I'll quickly go through what beef improvement as a mystery might look like. It's dependent upon our view of the world, our ability to view the world around us as a complex system rather than a series of events. It's not ranch, feedlot, packer, retailer, consumer. It's a system. It's our ability to collect and synthesize and make sense of a wide array of data and information. It's optimization modeling. It's the study of interactions. It's differences in scale, in time. It's differences in scope, firm versus the industry, for example. DHOC was one of the giants of the 20th century, and if you haven't heard about him, I encourage you to Google him and read on Wikipedia about him. He started in the late 1950s what we now know as VISA. He started the American, he thought up electronic digitized money. And he was a vice president of a small bank in California, and he changed the world. And DHOC, as he aged gracefully, I had the opportunity to listen to him and meet him, said that the problem was that the problem with dealing with complex systems, like beef improvement, is that we're inundated with data and information. And the challenge is to move it up those layers from data and information to knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And certainly, going from ratios to genetically enhanced EPDs is moving that way. I'm not arguing that at all. But there's lots of other things going on, too. And I'll tell you about those in a minute. The call to do that, the call to think about this as a system went out long, long ago by many industry leaders. In the 1970s, at A&M, a small group of people led by Dr. Thomas Cartwright, one of his students was Dr. Tom Jenkins, argued for optimization. And in some just tremendous papers that I'd encourage you to go reread, his graduate students and he wrote about optimizing nutrient allocation across an entire beef system, not within the borders of a ranch or within the borders of a feed yard or the fences of a feed yard, but across the system. He argued for the optimization of herd structure and age and marketing. And Chip, it reminds me exactly of what Burke did at Deseret. And he argued for the optimization of growth rate, milk production, and mature size for a given set of, and I should have highlighted that, variable resources. And he argued for the optimization of stocking rates and supplementation. The references are on the jump drive. At the same time, at MIT, and I don't know this, but I'm speculating that Cartwright was reading Forrester's work from MIT. Jay Forrester grew up on a ranch along the Dismal River in Nebraska. And he was he became, or he still is, a tremendous thought leader. And he created the study of complex systems at MIT. And he credited his ability to see and understand complexity with growing up on that ranch. He said, very eloquently, that in complex systems, things are tightly coupled. And I challenge you as I go through this list to think about examples in the beef in your branches and in your scientific studies. Think about how these might apply. So he said that, Forrester said that things are in complex systems, that things are tightly coupled. Everything affects everything else. He said that they're dynamic, that they change, and they change in multiple scales all the time. He said that they're policy resistant. And I'm going to offer up some of my own examples. We improve the efficiency of beef production to a level that is astounding, and we don't change profitability at the ranch in iota. And I've done the literature review to know that. We are still in low single-digit profitability levels at the farm and ranch level in an industry that has made huge strides in improving animal production. No matter how hard we try, we cannot change profitability. He mentioned that in complex systems, things are counterintuitive. And again, why wouldn't we have increased profitability by improving efficiency? And he said that in complex systems, there are trade-offs. And anybody in genetics understands trade-offs. He said that the complex systems behave that way because the nature of feedback misleads us. And that because we can't understand, we just don't have the capacity to understand complexity. And he developed tools just as complex as the Blutt model that we heard about last night for understanding complexity that are widely used in industry today, but not in agriculture. He suggested that most difficulties are internally caused, and the corrective actions often are the cause of problems or make problems worse. And you can hear this systems thinking now in the language of our culture. Einstein said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. You hear the first thing you need to do to get out of a ditch is to stop digging. If I could bring up those other slides, you can just see it. You hear the words unintended consequences everywhere now in our culture, because Forrester introduced that to us without any credit. But in animal genetics, in animal breeding, there have been lots of unintended consequences to what we've done. So I'm going to ask you to turn your kaleidoscope and look with me at some new thoughts and challenges and opportunities in beef improvement that are different than what we've been looking at in the past. So I just changed the kaleidoscope. So I'm going to give you some examples. And the first one is epigenetics. And epi is Greek for after. And if you just think about after genetics, and take this little trip with me. The definition of epigenetics is the mechanisms that allow an organism to respond to its environment through changes in gene expression. It was first kind of explored and studied by looking at a group of women who had been starved in a Jewish ghetto by the Nazis in World War II. And some of those women were pregnant, and some weren't. Some got pregnant during that period. And that experience impacted them, as you can imagine, greatly. But it also impacted their unborn children. And again, we know that environment affects our ability to express genes, right? But the curious thing was that starvation experience changed the health and lots of mature characteristics of those children differently depending on the trimester of pregnancy during the time in the ghetto. So starvation didn't affect pregnancy the same way. It affected it differently. All very negatively, but all very differently. And from that work has emerged this field of epigenetics. And I've been following the tremendous work of the University of Nebraska at the Goodmanson Station for its 20-some year history. And the work that's going on there now and in the last 10 years is really cutting edge and very, very exciting for beef improvement. Dr. Rick Funston and his team of Aaron Stocker, and I don't know all these young men and women, but Martin and Larson and a whole stable of great young thinkers, have looked at protein supplementation of cows and how it affected not only their performance and their breed back and their weaning weights, but their performance of their progeny and their progeny's progeny now. And so protein supplementation of cows during the winter time improved weaning weight of calves. It really neat. It increased the fertility of the female progeny, you know, 2 years later. It improved the carcass characteristics, or some of the carcass characteristics of the male progeny well over, you know, a year later, over a year later. And it improved the health characteristics of all male progeny. Now think about that for a minute, and think back to those characteristics of complex systems. What's been the founding, as Boggs and Berry and Strobing and these guys who are beating this drum about controlling costs for the last 20 years? It was to manage feed costs, wasn't it, Chip? And because winter supplementation was the largest portion of cow costs that you could really impact. And so, think about that, these trade-offs and those complex systems and time and scales of time. Lowering feed costs during the second and third trimester of a ranch in Nebraska or a ranch in South Dakota or wherever, it certainly could improve short-term profitability. But Rick's work is showing that it could decrease long-term profitability by affecting female fertility of fetuses that are being carried in that cow, or the carcass, or the feedlot performance of the males. That's unbelievable. Go back and think just for a little bit about postpartum management and gene expression. We know that creep feeding, and these are just some of the papers. There are lots of them. But some great work in Illinois showed that creep feeding improved marbling. But previous work that we all kind of knew, or we've known for a long time, creep feeding decreases lifetime productivity of females. So there again, postpartum management affects gene expression. No matter what the genetic potential of the animal was, postpartum management can change it. And Bruns at South Dakota State, along with Pritchard, show that aggressive implants affect marbling differently depending on age of the animal. But that's within weeks. It's just absolutely unbelievable stuff. So, regardless of genetic potential, postpartum management affects the biochemical processes that control gene expression. Last year, at BIF, Mike Engler and his team at Cactus reported about a study with almost 5,000 animals that the beta agonist zopaterol affected marbling differently depending on the genotype of in particular the leptin gene, on steers. And on a certain genotype, it reduced marbling by 16%, and it didn't affect marbling on another genotype. Right? I'll leave it at there, and I can show you the paper. I brought them all along. But think of the power of that. If the choice selects of bread is very wide, Mike can strategically use Zapaterol to one group of animals that it won't affect marbling with, but not to others that it might decrease it with. Or if the choice select bread is very narrow, and he only has to feed it for 3 weeks, if the choice select bread is very narrow, he can feed it to them all because it won't hurt him financially. So the interactions between management and genetics are huge, and we need to think about them. And this is the big aha for me about epigenetics. The challenge of then to beef improvement is it more cost-effective to increase gene frequency, which has been kind of the standard way we've done it, or to find an optimum level of gene frequency and turn genes on and off with management? That's really great stuff. And I'll put on my financial/economist hat. Another way of saying that is, what is the marginal cost of changing phenotype by increasing gene frequency versus the marginal cost of applying epigenetic strategies? Because it matters. It might be a lot cheaper to figure out how to turn the trigger or turn the switch on and off than it is to change generations and adopt technology to speed the fusion of genes. We don't know what the optimum level of genes are in a dynamic economy. We just found out, didn't we? We just had a sledgehammer upside the head in 07 and 08 that our bias that we needed lots of high marbling cattle didn't matter to someone who'd just lost their job. The elasticity of demand for choice cattle was huge. And they went to buy hamburgers and hamburger sales at all the major fast food restaurants increased. The elasticity of demand for hamburger was very small. So do we chase genes forever and ever and ever, or do we start turning switches on and off? I'm going to give you some examples of systems thinking and beef improvement beyond epigenetics. In 1995, and this was the first BIF I got to go to, I was still ranching. I got to go with my good friend Frank Felton, and Paul Bennett and I were saying, how could you come to Missouri and not, and I drove past the turnoff yesterday with Jen, and I didn't get to go see Frank. I went to Frank's ranch in Missouri so many summers in the 80s and 90s, And I hope he's here somewhere because he deserves to be. But Frank and I went to BIF in 95 in Sheridan, and I got introduced to Brian Melton. Dave, I think you got him there. And Melton challenged this industry that whole summer to incorporate economic relevance into its genetic evaluation of cattle. Remember, Dave? He wrote tremendous papers. He's still in Texas. I got to talk with him a lot and had lunch with him when I lived there. He's still provocative. He's still interesting. And I know that he wasn't the first voice to say that, Larry, or Dr. Cundiff. There were many people that had said that. It had been adopted in the swine industry. But for me, that was a tipping point. And I'm pleased to say, because of the work, the great work of Dr. Sally Northcutt I shouldn't mention names because there's so many, but Sally did great work with the Angus Association, that today all major breed associates, Mike McNeil, have economic selection indices. I have a little bit of problem with them. I can talk about it later. But by golly, that's synthesizing the world around us. It isn't just EPDs down a tunnel. It's EPDs in relationship to a dynamic economy. 6 years ago, in Sioux Falls, I challenged the industry to incorporate the principles of microeconomics into the evaluation and application of technology. I'm not sure how that's going. But we live in a production function, and we can go over the point of diminishing returns really easily. And at those kitchen tables, I've seen it again and again and again. And I'll tell you, some of the most profitable ranches I saw in Texas were some of the simplest ranches. I get a kick out of this one because I worked with two good friends, Dr. Charles Williams and Dr. Tom Jenkins, on this, and in the 90s. And they developed an optimization model for cattle that Tom called Deci. And it proves and displays perfectly that all the principles of that I put up there, that there are trade-offs, that things are counterintuitive. And Tom and Charles got data sets from real ranches in Nebraska, ran them through Deci, and it predicted exactly what would happen if you put too many cattle on that land, or you didn't supplement in the wintertime, and what fertility did. And it was kind of like driving my grandma's 1950 Chevy coupe with a 3-speed stick shift when I was 12 years old. It was a little rough, but if we can do LUP and all those other things that we hear about now with genetics and genomics, I'll tell you, we can do optimization models if we have the courage and the interest to do them. And with Deci, it's just sitting there waiting for the bright minds that are coming up to work on it and fix it and make it even better. So I get back to DeHaak's slide, because what Tom tried to do, what Brian tried to do, was to take tons and tons of data and information and help you pull it together into knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And I'm going to now switch to some creative, so those are some examples of systems thinking working in beef production, and there are many more, but I'm going to switch now and give you some creative systems thinking and go to my dear friend Steve Radakovich, who's one of the most creative, fun systems thinkers I've ever met. So we're at NCBA last spring in San Antonio, and Steve said, out of the blue, without a drink in his hand, "Since maintenance energy is used for bodily function and repair, if we reduce maintenance energy requirements by selecting for low-maintenance cows, do we reduce their longevity?" That's brilliant. And I don't know the answer. I hope somebody does. Think about that. And I understand that lots of maintenance energy is osmotic pressure gradient inside the cell and outside the cell. I get that. But I also know that the skin needs to be replaced. And I also know that organs need to be fixed and livers can regenerate. And that's what maintenance is for. And so we reduce, there's a kilocalorie of energy is a fixed thing. And by shifting it from one to the other, what is the long term, think back to those foresters' work, what's the long term effects of that switch? Another great, fun, crazy systems thinker, Dr. Fred Provenza, who recently retired from Utah State, who had turned his kaleidoscope and all of our kaleidoscopes about learned animal behavior and production. And he observed animals, grazing animals, some of them eating when they were in protein deficient areas of Utah, which for most of the time that would be most of the time, some would eat mice nests for the urine, for the nitrogen. Now, if there's Dick Quass up here and Barry Dunn down here in intelligence, that exists in all animals. And what if you could capture that power of learned animal behavior and intelligence? And if you think about it, if variation exists, you could select for it. And maybe we could select animals that are smarter, more adaptable, and can do a better job for us in some really tough conditions. Here's one of mine that I pulled out of our experience at the King Ranch Institute. We all know, and the literature is clear, that heritability for weaning weight is 0.4. So doing a economic selection indices for the King Ranch and their Santa Gertrudis herd, John Janot, using the Cornell model, ran 20,000 records, and I know that's not 9 million like Red Angus and Simmental have, but ran, to me, 20,000 is a lot. Ran it through the model, and the heritability came out at 0.1. How can that be? We all went to classes in animal breeding, and we were told by our professors that it's 0.3. I was told it's 0.35. It's clearly 0.4 out of the MARC data. Well, we've assumed that heritability is the same across all environments. And I have been trying, as I've thought about this over the last couple of years, and asking people, why in a not necessarily in a seed stock environment, but why in a commercial environment, in an area like South Texas or Utah or Nevada, why would we assume that crushing environment would allow for the expression of weaning weights potential? But we have. My friend Jennifer challenged our group whether our business models were correct. It's interesting to me that if variation is the key to genetic change and the genetic improvement of beef and beef improvement, why are we trying to make everything homogenous? The wine industry does not do it. They make everything different, and they have a very successful model. Because this goes back to Adam Smith in his Diamond Water Paradox. Scarcity creates value, not homogeneous meat counters of the same product. And this one's mine. Do we fully understand the drivers of profit? In the work that I've done on commercial ranches, depreciation is the second largest single cost for commercial cattlemen. And one key way to lower depreciation is to lower replacement rate, i.e. improve longevity. And at the same time, and I was remembering with Dr. Kunduf that in the 1970s when I was ranching, I wrote to him and asked him for a paper, and he sent me a thesis from one of his students that had done work at Fort Robinson on longevity, because I've been interested in this a long time. But at the seed stock level, what is one of our major powerful tools of genetic change? It's to roll generations fast. And so our genetics are being created in an environment of rapid genetic change and then moved to commercial application where that is, I'm not kidding you, it is damaging profitability. Can you have it both ways? Are there trade-offs? I think there are. So I was hoping for a few more introductions and then I wouldn't have to give this talk. I hope that I've challenged you to think about beef improvement as a mystery and not as a puzzle. I hope I've challenged you not to be passive and wait for the next big genetic tool to come down and be plopped into your toolbox, but to think about the world around you and synthesize and Google and explore things like epigenetics and visit with the Steve Radakoviches and the Fred Provenzas of the world and try to pull and challenge the Bob Webbers, the great young minds like Bob Webbers, to take us in a direction that is maybe bigger and broader than what we've done. It's easy to stand to pull out quotes from giants. Clearly, Dr. Keith Gregory was a giant. And way back in 1972, Keith, I'm going to read this quote. It's not as long as the ones Bob read last night. "I doubt if we stand a chance of achieving understanding of the components and the interactions among them as long as we insist on maintaining the comfort of our specialist or discipline zones. All indications to me are that we need more integrations of our disciplinary efforts, both within and among beef cattle problem areas, if we are to make the greatest contribution to developing technology for maximizing the amount of edible beef of a given quality per unit of resource use. I contend, and I challenge you, that for the stabilization and growth of U.S. beef industry, beef improvement will have to do some things like this. We're going to have to move beyond passively waiting for the next new thing. We're going to have to go beyond parochial interests of breeds, disciplines, and careers. And I know that within this group, within this hall today, there's great examples of that happening. And I'm on the web, I know, and I congratulate you. But I think we have to do more. I think we have to be broader and deeper than generally acknowledged. And that will give us a chance to synthesize existing data and information into wisdom. And I think we have to reward risk-taking. We have to look for the outliers among us, not just among our cattle. And we have to listen to their voices and accept their challenge that maybe something like epigenetics is a more powerful tool for beef improvement. I'm absolutely just throwing this out there for fun and debate. But maybe something like epigenetics is a more powerful tool than gene frequency. That's a beautiful picture of the South Dakota Badlands. It's been great to be with you. I'm not sure I'm doing questions or not, but so we'll debate or argue or wrestle for a little bit, if there are any.